This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. Are you ready to discover your True North Story? With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Messerol.
Vince and Rosemarie, John, are here in Seattle, but their journey started a long time ago, back on the other coast, right?
Correct, yes.
So, True North Story, we like hearing your journey and how you got to where you are today. The highs and lows, the bumps along the way of finding your life purpose. It could be a new thing, and it could be reinventing itself all the time. And for you guys, it came together in a beautiful book, which we'll talk about. But we want to hear about growing up outside of New York City.
Well, it was in New York City proper, but in Queens, New York.
Okay.
Yes.
So
when Martin Scorsese has a line in Quiz Show where he says, "Queens is not New York." And so that's kind of how everybody in Queens feels about it. We get to vote for the mayor, but nobody really takes us seriously.
And when you're growing up as a teenager, you're like, oh, well, maybe this weekend we'll go into the city.
Okay.
Like, well, you're kind of in the city already, but you mean Manhattan. That's where you want to go.
So explain to those who are not familiar with, there are five boroughs, correct?
Correct. Yes. Queens is one of them. It has both of the airports and a professional baseball team, and yet everybody there feels like they have a chip on their shoulder.
Okay.
They're second-class citizens, even though you can't get into New York without going to Queens first.
So wait a minute. So hold on a minute, Vince. So let me guess. So the major baseball team that you got there is the Mets, and how does that square itself with, like, all the Yankee fans? I would imagine that's a recipe for disaster.
Yes, you must know.
The Cubs and the White Sox, and John and I, before we signed our agreement to start a business together, I said the deal breaker could be which baseball team.
Okay,
exactly.
And what baseball team is it?
The Cubs, of course.
The North Side. I don't know. I guess the White Sox are technically more infamous. You know, from the 1918, you know, rigged World Series and all. But I don't know. The Cubs have yet to win a World Series in like 100-plus years. So there's infamy on both sides.
Yes.
And a lot of heart. So go ahead and
tell us.
Yeah. Tell us about the Mets and what makes that special to you guys.
Well, the Mets are a huge part of both of our lives in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's one of the things that we bonded over when we first met, is that we were both Mets fans. Now, if you live in Queens, they're thick on the ground, Mets fans. There's not a lot of Yankees fans there, so you don't actually feel odd about rooting for the Mets. Once you go into Manhattan or the Bronx, that's where you're lousy with the Yankees fans. And once you leave the city, everybody says, oh, you're from New York? Go Yankees. And then
you have to explain to them.
We have an actual senior circuit team in the city of New York that's quite good. I mean, it hasn't won 27 world championships, but it's won two. They were in it last year. They're a good team. Yeah. I am probably known a little bit too much as a Mets fan. It's a little sad how that's one of the things that everybody immediately knows about them.
Love it. Love it. You find each other in Queens, and you're both Mets fans. Tell us a little bit about how you connected and what drew you to one another.
Well, strangely, we did not find each other in Queens. We found each other in Florida, where we both happened to be.
Yes.
Yeah, and then realized
later.
Okay,
so we need to connect the dots from Queens to Florida. How does that work?
Well, Vince got there first.
Yes, and it was against my will. I had no say in the matter. My parents just said, no, we're going. And I thought you were supposed to go when you retired. That's
right. That's what most people do from New York, right?
Everybody from New York, you go when you're ready to retire. But, you know, my father worked for the airlines, so there was plenty of work for him to do just outside Tampa, St. Pete. So that's where we moved to. I finished up high school down there. And I got my first job there after graduating college. I was working at an advertising agency, working on their in-house magazine. And little did I know that up in New York
was another branch of that agency. It was fairly small altogether, but we did have the two offices, and I was working in the New York office, writing copy for the catalog that we did advertising specialties. And the owner said, you know what, I think it's time to close the New York office. We're going to move all the operations down to Florida. Do you want to come down there and help me do that? So I said, sure, because I didn't really want to look for a job immediately, so I'll help you move the office. I moved down there and met Vince in the office. So we had a little office romance going on.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like connection immediately? Like, wow, who's this girl that just walked into my life kind of thing?
For me, yes.
Aha.
It was not immediately reciprocal. But, you know, I know a good thing when I see it. And I had to be kind of, you know, I was more of a teardown than Rose was.
Well, I think Vincent first. I think he was a little daunted because I came down and I had an office and he was in a cubicle.
She was the vice president of the company and I was the lowest employee at the entire outfit. I was a single A baseball player suddenly in the majors was how I was looking at it. And it's like, no, I got a little pop. I think I can make this work.
And he would wander by my office and peek in, and I think he was looking for something like to start a conversation with. And I had pictures, this is a while ago now, cut out from Twin Peaks, which had just started, which was a cool show.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So he saw my Twin Peaks pictures and he started a conversation on that.
More than just writing and the Mets in common.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You guys enjoyed cinema, TV, movies.
Movies and old movies in particular. Because I still remember you pointing out to me that we'd been together for years at this point. She found an old diary that was from the period when we had first met. And she said, I actually found an entry where I wrote, Vince said Conrad Veidt to me today. And Conrad Veidt is an actor from Germany who's best known now for being the Nazi officer in Casablanca.
What was the meaning of that phone call? Victor Laszlo is on that plane. Why do you stand here? Why don't you stop him?
Ask Monsieur Rick.
Get away from that phone. I would advise you not to interfere.
I was willing to shoot Captain Reno, and I'm willing to shoot you.
Hello.
Put that phone down.
Get me the radio tower. Put it down.
And not a very well-known name.
Not a well-known name. It's like, you know, I mean, he had a great career, but still fairly obscure. And I just compared somebody we work with to Conrad Veidt because I knew she would be impressed.
And
you
were?
Yeah.
Yes.
And years later, I said, see, look, written confirmation that you were impressed with me.
Hold on a minute. And all that stems from the David Lynch line. Was it the Twin Peaks that you thought kind of opened you up to her, the things that were fascinating to her? Like, you know, like if you see somebody that's tied to, because David Lynch is a, it's an acquired taste. I mean, it's not.
Well said, John. Yes.
Exactly, right?
Really the icebreaker, I think, was the thing that enabled you to first start talking to me, and then we realized all the other things that we had in common.
It did stem from Lynch because he's one of those people, if you look at his work, it's drawing from all these other classic Hollywood forms. There's a lot of film noir in there. There's a lot of almost Douglas Sirk melodrama. And if you start talking seriously about David Lynch, you can go down the Hollywood rabbit hole of your choice. So
he was
the perfect place to start.
Watch Blue Velvet. I mean, you know, so you knew that you were kind of like-minded in some areas there. And how did that progress beyond the advertising agency, and where did things go from there? Because this is super interesting.
I don't know. In meeting Vince and talking to him in Florida, I had been pretty unsure of what I wanted to do next in New York. You know, my job was going away, obviously. And then I met Vince, and suddenly everything changed. It's like, well, I felt very soon after we got to know each other that I didn't want to spend a day without him, without talking to him.
And, okay, so
we're getting a little verklempt here.
We're getting Rosemary and I are getting a little emotional about this. It's a beautiful story. Oh my gosh, yeah. I love it.
Something happening there. I mean, like there's a connection.
Clearly.
So then, clearly, do you both want to go back to New York? Was the world your oyster?
I think we knew that neither New York nor Florida was going to be the oyster for us.
That was true. The world was our oyster, but we didn't want the part of it that was Florida. We knew that going in because you were never completely at home there, and I'd lived there long enough. New York seemed a little out of our reach at the time. And so we said, well, let's just go somewhere together.
Where neither of us has been.
And just start there. Just start from scratch in a place that's totally new to both of us. And again, I think this is where Twin Peaks comes into it. The show was still on the air. We said, well, let's go to Seattle. It's on the other side of the country. It's affordable. We would be able to make it, you know, like we could start out. Two crazy kids in love in a city like that could actually work. And so we just packed up all of our stuff and came out here. And we'd known each other for 6 months at that point.
Yeah.
Wow.
Our friends and relatives thought we were crazy to do that.
They were stunned.
Yeah.
Because we basically just told everybody, Yeah, we're going to move all the way across the country in about 2 weeks. So you want to throw
See
a party or come over and help us pack things, you should do it now.
You know, that is a recurring theme that Tam and I are coming across with a lot of True North Story guests, is that leap of faith piece that has really catapulted a lot of guests into another phase, leaving and going to Nashville, not knowing a soul, and, you know, turning that into something for a musician like James Otto. That's just amazing to me. So you decide that you're going to go to Seattle. Where does the courage come to make a move like that? I mean, that's what, 3,000 miles and out there in the Pacific Northwest, and you don't know a soul.
I think I had been to California once. Like, this is the most, I'd never really been on the West Coast. I had taken like one two-day trip for work to San Francisco. I don't know. I think it was because we had each other, that we were doing it together. I don't know that I ever would have done something like that on my own.
I agree. I mean, it's one thing to say you're going to go off to a new city and go to college, but there's a whole system of safety nets in place there, and you can always go home. But it took
exactly.
It took a lot for us to say, no, we're gonna commit to each other and to a new place and go there knowing that the only thing we have to rely on is each other.
That's huge.
That's powerful.
It is very powerful. And no jobs lined up necessarily.
No.
So you are taking a road trip, basically.
Yes.
Kind of, yeah.
A one-way road trip.
Exactly. Right. No return ticket.
Yeah. So when you get out there, then what? How did you guys identify what you wanted? I mean, obviously you had careers, or you had been working in advertising and writing and magazine publication type things. Were you looking for the same things when you got to Seattle, or jump us forward after you get there, what did that look like?
Well, I wasn't necessarily looking for the same thing. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. And we got here, we found an apartment, we each signed up with a temp agency, sent me to cover someone's maternity leave at Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center, which I immediately just loved. I thought it was great. The mission is amazing. I have been there ever since. I've been there for 25 plus years in a variety of different positions there. But once I got there, that was also kind of, I just fell into this place that just felt right.
Steadily working her way to the top, eliminating all competition. Ruthless in her ambition.
But she looks so innocent.
I know.
She does.
That's how she does it.
That's
nobody
right.
Nobody ever sees it coming.
Nobody expects it.
Don't they all? Isn't that the whole film noir thing?
Exactly. She'd studied with the masters and knew how to make her way.
And so that's for awesome. You, Vince, it was picking up writing gigs?
I had the exact opposite experience, where I basically scuffled along through a series of kind of low rent jobs. I mean, it's weird, the jobs you do that you like that don't actually last very long. I had a long period. I basically wrote phone sex ads for a living. A company that had circulars that they would mail out, and it turned out most of the money that they made was from phone sex ads. This is dating me now, because I don't even know if they have these lines anymore, 900 numbers. But that was how they made all of their money, and nobody wanted to handle those contracts, so I said, give them all to me. And very quickly, all the people who took out these ads said, why don't you write the ad for us? So it was, in many ways, the best job I ever had, because I could go in, and like for an hour and a half each morning, I would write these phone sex ads, and then I would just, you know, sit at my desk and read, or, you know, work on whatever other writing projects I had going. Best job I ever had, and it like only lasted for about 6 months.
Your point of view writing those ads, were you a woman or a man? Just a curious question.
That's a very good question. I would actually mix and match. Because I this is one of the things I would ask them, because like they would be able to tell me, well, ads with these words we got a lot more calls on, so try to use those words again. And then I would try to figure out, well, why those words? Is there some way I could like monkey with the combination?
This is SEO before SEO.
Exactly. And there's no way, there's no real metrics. You can't actually measure it. They can just say, well, I don't know. When it said hot, heavy, it was better than heavy and hot. So do whatever you can with that.
Who knew Vince was pioneering SEO and analytics?
I never thought of it like that, but you're absolutely right. It's primitive SEO.
And what's really crazy is around the same time, we've got Eddie Muller in 96 writing his book about Grindhouse.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when did you guys meet Eddie? Just so, I mean, I know, and we'll get into Vince, managing editor of Film Noir Foundation. So you're in Seattle and finding writing gigs, and then Rosemarie, you're at the Cancer Research, and then at what point does it kind of parlay into the meeting of Eddie and the Film Noir? And
I'm trying to remember what year that was, but I don't, but I know we were constantly going to the movies and revival houses around here. Like, we go to the movies twice or three times every weekend.
Or do you just enjoy all genres, all films, all the time?
Basically all genres. And especially when it comes to repertory stuff, anything that was revived, we would go to see, no matter where it was, in any venue. So, you know, they're showing a, you know, like a classic film outside, we would go to that. They would show it at the Paramount with you know, like the organ, full musical accompaniment. Anything from the golden age of Hollywood, we would be there. And I know Eddie had already established a pretty good reputation for himself by the time Dark City came out. So that is that's the year we first met Eddie. We can, you know, whatever the year Dark City was, he was doing a promotional tour and he came here and did an event at a bookstore. When I think about this now, it's amazing that he did this at the time. He cut together a little compilation of Film Noir himself that he had on a VHS cassette. They'd wheel in the TV with the big VHS player, like something from the AV department at high school. And he would pop this tape in, and it would be like his very quick little primer on the background of Film Noir. We were there for his big event in New York, and we got a signed copy of Dark City, and were able to talk with him a little bit. I remember we had just seen a movie called Follow Me Quietly for the first time. It had surfaced on television for the first time in years. We talked to him about that. We talked to him about Nightmare Alley with Tyrone Power, because it had just aired on AMC, back when AMC used to show classic films all the time. And Eddie told us, well, you just saw the last television airing of that movie for maybe 10 years, because the rights issues had become complicated and that was going to be the last time the movie aired on TV for a while. And he was absolutely right. It was the first time we ever talked to him. We cornered him at the end of the event and just wouldn't let him go for about 20 minutes. It peppered him with questions.
And then a few years after that, but not too long, he started his Noir City events here in Seattle.
Okay.
He'd been doing them in San Francisco, but then he started them here. And of course, immediately, as soon as we heard about it, we bought a passes, and were there every night. And you know how Eddie, of course, makes himself so accessible between the movies and before and after, so we just started talking to him.
At the time, I'd set up a blog, and I was writing a lot about classic film, just more for my own enjoyment, and to just get my name out there, because I thought, well, I have to start doing something. To my astonishment, when I introduced myself to Eddie, he said, oh yeah, I read your stuff. When are you going to write for the magazine?
That
he actually
so cool.
knew who I was and immediately was recruiting me to do something with the foundation. So from that moment, I was like, he totally won me over, and I will do whatever that man says.
You have become the managing editor of Noir City.
Yes. Again, careful planning, eliminating my competition, methodically making my way.
Very stealthy of you.
It's a lot harder, though, because they all know the tricks. So you've got to work twice as hard.
They've watched all the movies.
Yes.
Speaking of that, what are your favorite film noirs, both you, Vince, and Rosemarie? Like, do you have just one or two that these are our favorites?
Well, I'm going to jump right in because I have one that is my favorite, and that's Gilda.
Oh,
okay.
You and John,
top
really. Five. Oh, yeah.
I just
Come on,
I
Rita
love that
Hayworth,
movie. Rita Hayworth. Yeah, Glenn Ford. The interaction between those three characters, and then, of course, the gowns and the musical numbers. It's so great.
Yep.
I think of the scene when she's playing the guitar, sitting on the bar.
Yes.
The chemistry, the emotion, the things that are happening there, it's like it's crackling off the screen.
Yes.
Enough said.
It always kills me that that's one of those movies where some purists say, well, it's not really film noir because it's more of a melodrama, and I always think, if that's how you want to look at it, then fine.
Exactly.
You don't have to sit in the theater with us and have this amazing experience, because I'm happy to call that noir. Glenn Ford and Rita Hayworth, we do a noir couples feature, and they did a number of movies together. They tried to recreate that Gilda magic a couple times, and it didn't really work, but the two of them actually were very close in real life. They had kind of an on-again, off-again relationship for years.
Interesting.
That, in many ways, is more interesting than anyone that they played out on screen.
Yeah. What about you, Vince?
I always feel bad because the first two that come to mind to me are the ones that everybody says, but they're perfect introduction to film noir, but they're also perfect examples of film noir, and that is Out of the Past, Mitchum, Douglas, and
Jane Greer.
Jane Greer, absolutely. And Double Indemnity, because mm-hmm. you're just not going to get it better than that. I mean, that is a Swiss watch of a screenplay. Everything is set up. Everything pays off. There's just fantastic emotional punch at the very end in that last scene between Fred McMurray and Edward G. Robinson. I mean, there's absolutely nothing about that movie that doesn't work. I always go back to those two where I say to people, just watch these two movies and tell me you will not want to watch more of them.
Start with those three, you would have a collegiate education just in those three movies if you saw no others. Another one I would throw in there just for our audience is Asphalt Jungle. Maybe because I didn't know who Sterling Hayden was. He's not a Fred McMurray. He's not Robert Mitchum. But yet that character in that movie was so broken, and I felt he communicated that in a way that just spoke to me at an emotional level that I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just a personal thing to me. I like the fact that Marilyn Monroe showed up in there in a kind of a cameo. You would argue that's film noir. It's just more of a kind of a heist noir, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a heist film, but it is film noir through and through. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect example, and you're so right about Sterling Hayden in that movie, just giving you a quintessential noir character and showing you all the pain without revealing it in any obvious way. Yeah, he's just like a bullet going through that movie, trying to let you know that he's impervious to all of this, but you know that inside, he's just going through all of this turmoil and torment. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So you guys made appearances on game shows.
We did that in the same year.
So did you go to tryouts?
Yeah.
Yes. It was a complete happenstance that we both did it and that we both got on at the same time. It was within 3 months we had both appeared on these game shows. It was just baffling.
I had heard that the folks from Jeopardy were coming to town and they were having tryouts at the Westin. You just had to sign up and you could go. And I said, well, of course, yes, I want to do that. And they put you in this big ballroom where you take a written test that, you know, the questions are up on screen, but you're writing down your answers. And it must have been a couple hundred people there. And then they grade the tests and then they call out the names of the people who did well enough on the test. And I was one of the people who got to stay. And you do like a little fake game show at the front of the ballroom. And they said, okay, we may call you. You'll go on our list. Maybe you can get to be on Jeopardy. And less than 2 weeks later,
wow,
they called me. And I was like, yes. The studio, it's a Sony picture studio in Culver City. And then they get you on a little shuttle bus and take all the contestants for the day to the studio. They make you up, which was great. And then they pick you at random to be on any particular show. So there's enough of us to film 5 days worth of shows in one day. And so if you don't get picked immediately, you sit there and watch them tape other episodes.
So it's like jury duty.
Right, it's like jury duty. That's exactly what it's like. I didn't get picked until the very last shoot of the day. So you sit there and watch all these categories go by. It's like 80s fashion. Oh, I could have answered those questions. But you take what you get, right?
Which could be Canadian geography.
Yes.
And fly fishing.
Fly fishing was one of my categories, but it was so much fun.
Meanwhile, you're on an IFC film fanatic.
Right. This is our relationship in a nutshell, which is Rosemary immediately goes to the most famous, most beloved game show, the one that everybody in the country watches. And I'm on the one that's on the Dicey channel at the high end of the dial that no one has ever heard of.
True North Story, the original podcast series. Meant to inspire, encourage, motivate, and offer hope. And now, back to the program.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. It's not unusual to have fun with anyone. But when I see you hanging about with anyone, it's not unusual to see me cry.
One of the reasons I wanted to be in the game show was it had a celebrity panel. And I am a sucker for the idea of, like, I want celebrities around me as much as possible. I want to be judged by famous people. And so I loved this idea. And so the show had been on for a year, and I watched it religiously. And was saying, I don't know about this, how good a show this is. I could kill on this show, but I'm never going to get a chance. And then they announced they're doing tryouts in Seattle. And they're doing them at the movie theater that we go to pretty much all the time. So I said, well, Rosemary basically said to me, well, here you go, smart guy.
Yeah, you said you could do better than these people we've been watching. Go ahead and do it.
Here's your chance. And so I went down there, and they asked you a couple of trivia questions, and you have to – it was a weird game show in that it was three rounds. One is trivia. One is debate. I can't remember the last time there was a game show that had a debate segment on it. And then the whole point of the show was who was the biggest film fanatic. And you had to show – things that you had collected over the course of your life that demonstrated how you were just insane about movies. And that was the part that I said, if I get on the show, that's where I'm going to fall apart. Because I don't know what the collecting gene is. I only know that I don't have it.
I don't have it either. John has a collection.
Yes.
Of small cars.
Yes.
From
1/64 scale diecast.
Ooh. From a plethora of movies.
Ooh.
Wow.
That's
so this
cool,
is this
though.
Is a serious collection. There's,
this is
there's,
a serious collection.
There's intent behind this,
oh,
John.
Yes.
For example, the Porsche 917 from Le Mans that Steve McQueen drove, the light blue one, the Golf of Porsche, I have one of those. That's probably my most expensive one. That cost me a pinky finger. No, I'm kidding.
But who uses the pinky finger?
And then I have a Jim Rockford gold Pontiac Firebird and Tulane Blacktop GTO and 1968 Mustang from Bullitt. And
Vince is just shaking his head in astonishment and awe because...
You should be so happy you don't see my face right now. I'm like, I'm already figuring out ways. I'm like, putting, oh yeah, what did I learn from Asphalt Jungle where I could use to get the little Jim Rockford car?
Exactly.
So Vince, back to your IFC game show. How did it go for you? You obviously were picked.
I was picked, and they flew us all down together as six contestants total, a great bunch of guys. I'm still friends with them to this day. The hardest thing about it was everything about the show was about movies. And when they picked us up at the airport, they said, you can't actually talk about movies to each other because we don't want you to maybe give an answer to someone now that will help them on the show. So try to keep the conversation about movies to a minimum. So first of all, this is about, like, 75% to 80% of my conversation anyway. Even higher for some of the other guys who were on the show. But I remember we're walking through LAX and there's this corridor in the airport that Lee Marvin walks down in Point Blank. It's the famous shot where you just hear his shoes against the linoleum. And it's also where Pam Grier is introduced in Jackie Brown. She's walking down the exact same hallway. We all get off the plane and we're all walking to the van down this hallway, and the entire time I'm saying, Point Blank, Jackie Brown, and I can't say any of this to anyone. And I'm looking at the other guys, and I'm saying, they all know it too. So the six of us are we're like hitmen who've just flown in for a job because we're just concentrating on the job at hand because we can't say to each other how awesome it is that we're in this famous movie location. Mm-hmm. We're just silently moving to where we need to go.
It's the definition of torture right
oh,
there.
Oh, yeah. Even on the drive to the airport, I'm going, that's a location that I know, that's a location that I know, and we can't say anything about it. And they put us up at a hotel that's owned by Beverly Garland, who was a famous actress from the 50s. So, like, everything about this trip is about the movies and how much we love the movies, and we're not allowed to talk to each other about it, at least until they tape the show. The second we taped the show, it was the only thing that we discussed.
Did you do all right?
I made it all the way to the final round, and exactly as I predicted, I just crashed and burned.
You didn't have any diecast cars.
No. Had I known that you then, John, maybe my life would have been different. You had to have three different items to present in this last round where you were judged by the celebrity panel, who is Henry Rollins and Keith David, the character actor, who, as a friend of mine keeps pointing out, is one of the only people to survive The Thing. It's him and Kurt Russell who make it all the way through the remake of The Thing. Academy Award winner Tatum O'Neill is the last judge. So it's a nice group. And we have to bring three items that we can present to say how crazy we are about movies. And I rack my brain and come up with two. I printed out a bunch of pieces that I wrote for my website to say, I write about movies for free and nobody pays me. I just like them that much. And I still had the key that I was given when I was a movie theater usher. I worked all the way through high school and college as an usher at a bunch of different theaters. And at one of them, you had to have a special key to turn the lights on and off. And I never took it off my ring because it was a nice little reminder of the whole sense of being behind the scenes at the movies. And we would get the movie that was going to open on Friday, but we would queue it up on Thursday nights and we would screen it at midnight just for the staff. And that kind of emotion meant a lot to me. And so that was, you know, one of the items that I presented. And then I said to Rose, I got nothing. I have no third item. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
And she gave me a statue that she had bought herself that looks a little bit like the Maltese Falcon. Yeah,
it was actually a planter. What?
It was a planter that looks enough like the Maltese Falcon. And so I invented an entire history for this. I was going to explain how I stumbled on this in a little, you know, shop in Chinatown, and it looked enough like the Falcon, and how it... And I never got the chance to present it because the guy I was up against just crushed me. The very first thing he presented was movie reviews that he had written when he was 8 years old. He wrote reviews for every movie that he saw starting from when he was a child, and he kept them all in binders. And he would sometimes draw illustrations.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, I don't stand a chance here. It was a fantastic experience. Henry Rollins said that I seemed presidential compared to the other contestants on the show, which is still, talk about high points.
Okay.
Having Henry Rollins basically endorse you.
On your bucket list to be recognized by a celebrity.
Yes. It happened in such a short period of time that we both ended up getting picked for these game shows. It all happened over the course of one summer.
Tim and I don't believe in coincidences, and I think very few people do. I just don't believe that things happen just for no reason. So let's fast forward here a little bit, and I want to ask you, you've got this amazing book we're going to talk about, Design for Dying, and it's going to be ongoing. Let's start with Renee Patrick. That
yes.
is you two as writing together as a team. Where did that name come from, and what's the significance of that?
Renee is my confirmation name.
And Patrick is my middle name.
And we decided to put them together.
We liked it because Renee Patrick sounds like the name that an actress who came to Hollywood in the 40s would have been given. It's just, it sounds like something a guy with a cigar in his mouth would, he'd lower it and say, "Sweetheart, now you're Renee Patrick."
No more Gertrude
so
McGillicuddy.
Yeah. It sounds classy but fake, which is what we're all about. If there's a Renee Patrick brand, that's what it is.
So Renee Patrick is the pen name for the two of you.
Yes.
Because, as collaborators and co-authors.
Yes, because we thought if it had... my concern is if a book has two authors' names on it, people will think it'll be twice as good. It's like a little secret.
And the other thing is that Renee Patrick is... I think it shows that the two of us together actually make something different. You know, there's like, it's like a third person almost.
Yes, you each bring something unique to the table.
Right,
yes.
And it ends up in this amalgam of a new person.
We had this conversation where at some point during this process, Renee Patrick became... another person to me. I would mention this to Rosemary. I would say, well, you know, well, you don't want to get Renee mad because Renee, in my head, Renee was a little scary. Renee was one of those people, you know, like Martha Stewart, where she, or Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada, where she's very collected and very pulled together and just so effortless and elegant. And if she turns on you, you would just turn into ashes. But the other thing about having Renee that's great is it's the tiebreaker. We would get into these places where we were working on the book, and often it came down to jokes where one of us would say, I think it's funny, and the other one would say, I don't think it's funny. And at some point we would say, okay, well, we know what you think, and we know what I think. What does Renee think? Every time we asked that question, we would both kind of step back, and we would intuitively know what Renee would think.
Right, that would give us the right answer.
It took a while before Renee sort of, you know, coalesced into a person that, you know, would, you know, like this other that we could turn to. But once we both realized that happened, it made the whole process so much easier.
So the whole idea for writing a book together, Vince, you were the writer and Rosemary had the concept?
Yes.
Sitting over dinner or a cup of coffee or something and said, I have got an idea.
I've got an idea. That is where it happened. Well, step back a little bit because I had an idea to write an article for Noir City, the magazine. And I thought everybody goes to, well, not but a large proportion of people go to the Film Noir Festival and they want to see the clothes. It's about like going back into that vintage, into the clothes of the era and the makeup and everything. I said, well, there should be an article in the magazine about the fashions of film noir, and I should write it. So that sounded like a good idea, and I started to do research and came across Edith Head. You know, and I had known her name, but I was reading about her. And then one day, over coffee, as you said, I said to Vince, I have an idea. What if Edith Head were a detective? She knew everybody in Hollywood. She knew everybody's secrets. She was had a huge, long career there. What if she were a detective in a mystery novel?
And I immediately reacted to this. It was, to this day, it's still kind of shocking to me because I said, and she's sort of a Nero Wolfe figure who has like a young aspiring actress who goes out and gets all the clues. And while Edith is designing all of these movies, she gets the information, solves the crime, and it spans the entire length of her career. And all the famous people she'd ever worked with would wander in. And Rose said, well, I hadn't gone that far into detail, but yeah, that sounds great.
Sure.
And I said, we're leaving here right now.
Okay.
And going home and starting to put this down on paper, because the second I heard this, I thought it was an absolutely brilliant idea. I loved everything about this idea. And the fact that I'd never had an idea that good in my life didn't bother me all that much. Because, I mean, the hardest part was I immediately said to her, what do you want to do with this? Because someone has to do something with this idea. And if you want to undertake it by yourself, I'll do anything I can to help you. But is this something that we want to do together? So we sat down and blocked out what was going to happen in the book together, which in and of itself was an education to me, because Rose insisted, I want to do this on index cards. I want to be able to see the plot visually and be able to move things around really easily if we decide to change things up. And that was not how I worked. I'd never done that before.
For some reason, and just the way Vince is, he could keep everything in his head at once. It's like, I cannot do that. I cannot keep an entire story with this kind of complexity and reversals and plot points and stuff. We need to like lay it out. I need to be able to see it in front of me.
So your learning and doing styles were different.
Yes.
Right.
And Rose is still working at the Hutch during the day, right?
Yes.
And we all know that creatives can get creative at 2 a.m. and stay up half the night. So how did you guys mix your lives and be writing at the same time?
It came along at the right time because I was working at a video game company. Hours were a little different. And so 2 nights a week at least, I would be out of the house. I would be at the office doing having writing meetings. And that meant that there were 2 complete evenings where Rose could just work on the book without me puttering around and making noise. And
being there because I like talking to him. So if he wasn't there, I couldn't waste time talking to him. I would have to be working on the book.
Okay, okay.
And I had decided that we worked out the plot together, and Vince wrote, he kind of banged out an outline, and I said, I would really want to write the first draft because since I'm not a writer, I was like, I have to prove to myself that I can do it. And so while Vince was out at his meetings, I would just sit there and write, and then on the weekends. So just evening and weekends, and it took, say, 3 years.
So what was your biggest challenge, would you say, Rosemarie? A lot of people, especially in today's society, they say they're writers. Everyone's a writer, whether it be 140 characters or less on Twitter. Yeah. I'm a writer. So first-time writer, you've got the outline, you and Vince kind of have the concept. And what was the single most daunting thing for you to have to overcome to complete the first draft and then the subsequent second draft?
Really, I think it was getting out of my own way in doing it, because you have this image in your head of, oh, it's going to be as funny as P.G. Woodhouse and it's going to be as gripping, you know, as Dashiell Hammett or something. And you start writing it and you're like, Joe walked to the door. It's like, oh my God, the reality, what you have in your head is so different from actually the actual doing of it. Mm. And so I had to say, you know what? It just needs to get down there. It needs to be on paper. And then I need to know I can go back and make it great. That was what I was kind of saying. Make it great the second time. Just get it down on paper the first time. And just ignore that, oh, it's not good enough as you're doing it. Because I have a very strong voice in my head that says, oh, this is terrible. Why are you even trying? This is terrible. It's like, no, I have to get past that and just do it and then make it better. So there was a lot of talking to myself in order to get it done.
A lot of writers fall into that where, you know, they want to rewrite what they've just written. You'll never finish. You'll never get to the end to go back and say, okay, this is what we can fix. This is what we can strengthen. This is what we can remove. This is what we can edit. And you start to shape. It's like a sculptor, you know. If you're constantly lopping the head off and starting over again, you're never going to get anything done, right?
Oh,
that's
true.
Yeah. Plow through and get to the end of it.
After that second draft, Vince, you said, we need to find a literary agent. We need to put this in a contest. What did you do?
Once the second draft was done, then I went through the entire draft. We still hadn't figured out that synthesis that made Renee Patrick. It was still basically Rosemarie's version. And then I wrote a version based on her version. We printed out 2 copies and sat next to each other at a table and went through it a page at a time. And at the end of that, we'd figured out who Renee Patrick was and what she sounded like. So that, like, added another year to the process, but we said, I think we need to do this, because as soon as we started looking at the draft, we realized this isn't you and it's not me anymore. It's this third entity, and let's make sure that she has her full voice before we send this out to anyone. And we were in the midst of that process when I remembered this competition that is run every year by a fantastic conference called Malice Domestic. That's dedicated to the traditional mystery novel. They have it every year in Bethesda, Maryland. And they give a grant every year to the best unpublished novelist, somebody who's writing a traditional mystery novel. And we had the first few chapters under our belt, what we think of now as the Renee Patrick chapters, mm-hmm. the ones that we had both gone through. We entered it into the contest in 2013 and won that year. You received an actual cash award. They gave you a grant that you were meant to use to further your education as a writer. And they invite you to a conference. And so we went out to Malice Domestic and had the most phenomenal time. I mean, to talk about walking into a place and finding your tribe, finding your people. We were welcomed in immediately, particularly by all the people who run the grants program. Anyone who had ever won the award in the past, they have a phenomenal track record. So many people who won this award have gone on to become published authors.
So we get to go on stage, and we had our, you know, 45 seconds of what we were going to say and thank everybody for accepting the award. But when the woman who was introducing us announced, oh, and their book is in their book, Edith Head is a detective, everyone in the room went, oh.
A gasp, like an audible gasp. Yeah. And again, we both actually physically stepped back from the microphone.
Like, oh, wow, what was that?
And afterwards, there's a mystery writer, Hank Philippi Ryan, who's become a mentor to both of us and such a good friend, pulled us aside afterwards and said, did you hear that noise after they said Edith Head? That was a room full of writers saying, why didn't I think of that?
Oh my goodness.
So that was a great
feeling. That is awesome.
And to get that kind of validation that early in the process, I don't think you can put a price on that. I mean, to have that many people who do this for a living say, this is a good idea, to the extent that I wish I'd thought of it myself, and you need to finish this.
Right.
That lit a fire under us, and we said, we have to get this done. I mean, we were already determined to get it done, but to know that people are interested in it and would like to read it, you just immediately want to wrap it up.
Yeah, and then after the banquet was over and people were milling out, there were a few agents in attendance at the convention who came by and said, oh, the book sounds so great. When it's done, feel free to email me and maybe I'll take a chance, take a look.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, what that taught us was there's so much to be gained by putting yourself out there. I mean, mm-hmm. if you just by entering this competition and opening ourselves up to the criticism, but also the acceptance of these people, created opportunities for us we never would have gotten otherwise.
So in this particular collaborative effort, it worked better as a team, right? And sometimes working with someone else that can look at it and come back and say, well, what if we move this piece here first and then this happened and then that led to that?
Oh, I think it definitely does. It's funny what you said, because I think Vince is the king of, why don't we move this over here, and then it solves like six problems. Like, how did you ever think of that? That's, yes, of course we should do that.
And then I have to reorganize my index cards.
Well, yeah.
Yes,
to match.
To do that. Yeah. Yes. So you guys have together kind of that creative side as well as the organizational administrative side, and together it makes Renee Patrick work. Right?
Absolutely.
Best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
The best of both worlds. So we've got Design for Dying. That came out in
April of this year.
April of this year, yeah. And people can find it
everywhere.
Online.
Where fine books are sold.
Aha.
Yeah, it's from Forge Books, so you can pick it up at bookstores or online, anywhere.
That's so great. And then you say this is the beginning of an amazing series for Edith. Is she going to have her little cohort with her in the next book?
Definitely.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Edith and Lillian are both in Dangerous to Know.
Okay.
Which will be out in April of 2017.
In April of 2017. Yes. So we have stuff to look forward to.
Yes.
Absolutely. And we'll put a link on the blog post for the podcast, too, which people, will be able to link directly to your book and be able to buy it,
Fantastic.
From Amazon.
That's great.
Exactly, for sure. And we can push people to the Renee Patrick website too, and just whatever mm-hmm. else you have.
Yeah, what are your social media handles that we can direct people to find you?
And your blog too, Vince, as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's one of the things about this process that's been in really tricky is that we each have the social media profiles and then Renee has one.
Right.
So we're like, it's schizophrenic in that something will come up and we'll say, well, wait, am I supposed to say this or should Renee say this? And if Renee says it, am I supposed to retweet it? It uh-huh. gets very confusing.
I would think
right.
so. Yeah. So but Renee has a Facebook page.
Renee's on Facebook, and she's also on Twitter at R. Patrick Books.
Okay.
And people can sign up for our newsletter too, which we're just starting. Where everyone who signs up for the newsletter gets a copy of the article that eventually we did write for Noir City about the noir fashions of Edith Head.
Oh, fantastic!
That goes through some of her films.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And then you have a blog, Vince, that you are continuing to write?
Yes, yes.
And that can be found at?
That's at vincekeenan.com.
vincekeenan.com, vincekeenan.com.
Yes.
Fantastic. We are so happy to have had you guys here at True North Story and to hear about your journey and kind of be along for a fun ride in a...
So much fun.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us.
Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Oh, we're so glad. So, Design for Dying, John, I'm going to send you your copy. A Beguiling Champagne Cocktail, which cheers to you, my friend, for all of your writing about cocktails.
Thank you.
Let us not forget that.
Yes.
When you two go out for a drink, do you order something fancy schmancy off of all of your writings that you've found that you love, or... Are you what's your go-to cocktail?
Typically when we go out, I like to trust the bartender. Like I like to go to a bar where they put some thought into their drinks list and I will order what seems most appealing to me on the drink list or at any number of bars in Seattle where I am somewhat known. they know the profile. They'll walk in and they'll say, "Oh, you want a rye drink? You want it stirred, you want it a little bitter," and they'll come up with something fantastic.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And how about for you, Rosemary?
I'm more like a gin gal.
I think.
So I like a drink with gin in it. But I also, we'll look at the list and see, what do they think they're liking?
Okay. So, profiling people, can you kind of pick out who likes what sitting near you at the bar or no?
It's more confusing than you would think. I mean, a drink that I never really understand is people will come in and order a vodka soda. Because there's not really, the vodka usually doesn't have any taste. The soda, it's not a particularly flavorful drink. And I am astonished by the number of people and the variety of people who order it.
Wow.
I'm always amazed where you'll see like three dudes come in, talking about the game, slapping each other on the back, and then they'll all get vodka sodas. It's like, come on, guys, don't you want whiskey? Whiskey's good.
Yes, you do. You do want whiskey.
Definitely.
So you wrote a book about drinks and cocktails, yes?
Yes. It started as a personal interest of mine. I mean, I didn't actually start drinking until I was in my 30s.
Okay.
Because it's weird. Both of my parents are from Ireland, and the Irish are...
Notorious
in some circles for drinking, but both of my parents actually took what they call the Pioneer's Oath, and so they never drink. My mother's never had a drop of alcohol in her life outside of sacramental wine at church, and my father would have maybe one drink a year. And so when I grew up, I had no interest in drinking. It never really occurred to me. And then I was in my 30s, and I went to a bar in Seattle here called the Zigzag Cafe, and they... immediately took such good care of us that I got pulled into this cocktail world. And within 2 years, I started writing articles for basically for my own edification about these different cocktails. And I ended up collecting them into a book that I published through Amazon called Down the Hatch, One Man's One-Year Odyssey Through Classic Cocktail Recipes and Lore. And from that, I ended up getting hired at a couple different magazines to be their cocktail writer. And it's become a second job that I still have to this day.
A delicious second job.
A delicious second job.
It's so great for me because in the book, he gives recipes for the cocktails, but of course he's tested them all at home. And I
because I'm very thorough.
He's very thorough, and I'm a beneficiary of that because he tests the cocktails like, oh, what do you think? Oh, thanks, honey.
Wow, how nice
it's
is that?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a gift that keeps on giving right there. I mean, a gift to be able to write and a gift to be able to create cocktails. And you get paid for it now.
Yeah.
Yes. And classic cocktails. So that's so great. It's just like, you know, going into the, remember in the movies, can I fix you a drink? And they would go over to the lovely little bar with all of the lovely little, you know, containers.
Yeah.
That happens at home at your house now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's nice when your interests sort of back each other up.
No kidding.
And so there's a lot of nice overlap between, you know, classic film, especially film noir, and cocktails. They just go together.
They
perfectly.
Do, don't they?
Yeah.
Seems to be that way. So we've got your online book about cocktails, which will include, as well as this bubbly, delightful champagne cocktail of a crime novel that's been described in the New York Times, Design for Dying. Renee Patrick, as in Vincent Rosemarie Keenan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @True North Story. And tune in next time for another True North Story.